You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 26th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Could the two most important world leaders at COP26 be two who aren't coming? Amnesty International joins the exodus from Hong Kong, and are hippopotamuses people? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Mary Dujewski and Jonathan Fenby, will discuss all the day's big stories and the anthropomorphization of pachyderms, and we'll have a report on how global supply chains are changing. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Mary Dujewski, foreign affairs commentator and columnist for The Independent, and by Jonathan Fenby, author and former editor of newspapers here in the UK and in Southeast Asia. Hello to you both.
Hello.
By way of cunningly further foreshadowing our final item today, I did want to ask you each if anything exciting or indeed at all had ever happened to you in connection with a hippopotamus, or failing that, any other kind of pachyderm?
Only not seeing one when I'd rather hope to see one.
That's disappointing.
That's very disappointing.
Where did this utter non-event occur?
On safari. But I did manage to see rhinoceros, and baby rhinoceros, so that was very good.
That's pretty cool.
Almost compensation.
I did see hippopotamus on a safari in South Africa. Well, I say I saw hippopotamus. I saw the thing where you can see like their eyes and the tops of their head in a pond, and you're told not to get too close. So for all I know, the rangers might have just sort of, it might have been an installation that was just there.
Well, you're both way ahead of me. I have never been on a safari, and I have never knowingly gone seeking a hippopotamus.
Yeah, I wouldn't open with that, and yet you just have. We will return to the reason for the hippopotamus discourse later in the show, but first to Canada, where the recently more or less re-elected Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has been announcing his new cabinet. I'm joined from Toronto by our bureau chief, Thomas Lewis. Thomas, first of all, for whom has this been good news?
Well, it's been good news for two people in particular, Andrew. Both of them women, Melanie Joly, who is the new Minister of Foreign Affairs, and Anita Anand, who is the new Minister of Defence. Now, for Melanie Joly, it really marks a pretty incredible political turnaround for her personally. She was the Minister of Heritage back in 2015 when the Trudeau government was first elected. And she wasn't really deemed to have done a particularly strong job. And then she had a demotion pretty much after that. So now to be given basically one of the top jobs at a time when the foreign affairs portfolio is a pretty complicated one in many respects for Canada is really being seen as a pretty huge achievement for her. And then Anita Anand, she's the first woman to lead the defence ministry in Canada since 1993, I believe. And again, she takes over at a time when there's a really huge reckoning underway within Canada's military over allegations and discoveries of misconduct and sexual misconduct in various areas. And she is a very, very accomplished former legal scholar, and she's a very respected person. And there's a sense that this really marks a very big changing of the guard, if you like, in terms of how the military moves on from these accusations and from the investigations that are still ongoing. So those are the two big names that have done very well today, I'd say, Andrew.
And who is trying to style out a demotion as an exciting new challenge that they're really looking forward to?
Well, that award, I'd say, goes to Harjit Sajjan. He was the former now Minister of Defence. He, again, is a pretty popular figure within the government of Justin Trudeau. He's been Minister of Defence since the government was first elected back in 2015. And we spoke to him for Monocle, actually, a few years ago, just after he'd been appointed to that role. But the perception was really, Andrew, that given that the reckoning in Canada's military has really been so deep and is still ongoing, there was was just a feeling there really needs to be a change at the top, really. And Harjit Sajjan now becomes the Minister for International Development, which is an important job, but I think most people are seeing that as a demotion in all but name.
I mean, those are reasonable reasons for making changes, certainly. But how much of this is Trudeau trying to create some sense of excitement after having called an early election to try and change things, but which turned out to not have changed very much?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. And there was a lot of commentary. Obviously, the election took place at the end of September, and we haven't really heard much of him for several weeks about when the new government would, you know, take up its post and would start the job, if you like. And I think, you know, if you look at how expansive this reshuffle has been, it's a pretty big cabinet. I think there are 38 ministers involved. And there have been quite a lot of changes, quite a lot of new faces, some quite notable omissions, actually, as well. But there's been an interesting line of commentary today in the Canadian press has been covering this, about the idea that perhaps Justin Trudeau won't be seeking re-election next time around. And perhaps there is kind of some desire within the party to try and make the conditions for a woman to succeed him. The Liberal Party of Canada is the only major party never to have had a woman at the helm. So I think by having, of course, Chrystia Freeland, who's remained as Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, as well as Melanie Joly and Anita Anand now all at the top table, that maybe that is a signal that he is making about what might come next when he eventually steps down, whenever that might be, Andrew.
Thomas Lewis in our Toronto Bureau, thank you very much for joining us. We go now to our panel, Jonathan and Mary, and we'll start with COP26, the 2021 UN Climate Change Conference, which will begin this Sunday in Glasgow. Earlier today, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres described the UN's latest climate report as, quote, a thundering wake-up call, unquote, and noted that the leadership the planet requires is off, as he put it, and far off. It is easy to believe that Guterres was thinking specifically of the leadership of China and Russia, neither of whose leaders will be attending COP26, despite the fact that those two countries between them account for nearly a third of the world's CO2 emissions, though Russia would be entitled to observe that this figure is comprised of their 5% and China's 28%. Jonathan, first of all, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin both are no-shows for COP26. Why aren't they coming?
Well, Xi hasn't been anywhere, as far as we know, throughout the COVID pandemic period. He's stayed at home. He's made various video appearances, which I suppose he might still make at the Glasgow conference. But what you get, very much the feeling from China, is that Beijing wants to make its own policy on these matters. There was a policy document issued on Sunday night, which very pointedly said that managing pollution reduction must be linked with considerations of energy security, industry, food security, and so on. In other words, at a time when Xi Jinping is facing quite a lot of major challenges at home on the economy, on living standards, and so on, and has an ambitious agenda himself, he wants to basically not find himself or China tied by any promises made by a big conference like the one in Glasgow.
Mary, if Xi Jinping had changed his mind and decided to go, might Vladimir Putin have changed his mind and decided to go?
That's a very interesting thought. I'm not sure about that, because like Xi Jinping, Putin has also been very protective of himself under the COVID restrictions. And I think it would be true to say that although he's met various leaders in person recently, he hasn't been out of the country, and he's been very carefully protected. So I think it was probably a long shot to think that he might travel to Glasgow. But I'd also say that, yes, I mean, for the British, probably, it's more important that these two great figureheads are not going to be at Glasgow than it is for the representation of either Russia or China, because I think Russia will send their Putin special envoy on climate change, who has a lot of authority and has made quite a lot of public statements. And I think Russia's policy on climate change is actually quite interesting, because until about 3 years ago, they were very blasé about it and said, well, really, it doesn't affect us in any way. It would probably be positive. But in the last few months, especially, they've been much more concerned about it. And one of the reasons is the forest fires and rising temperatures in Siberia, the possibility that that the permafrost might melt in places which would destroy some of their Arctic Circle cities. So those are all fears that they've got. But of course, they also, I think, very much want to have a seat at the top table on climate change, because given that the weight of their exports is very carbon heavy, they don't want to watch as the whole of Europe goes carbon neutral and all their export market is threatened. So I think they very much want to be in on the terms.
Jonathan, Mary correctly notes that Russia has had really to come to terms with the reality of climate change as climate change begins to directly affect Russia, as it was always going to, a country of its enormous size and especially its large frozen regions. But is the same not true of China? I mean, they have had a fairly bracing education in the reality of this in the last few years as well. Do you think China is taking it accordingly seriously?
Yes, absolutely. The need to reduce pollution in the big cities, in particular in China, plus desertification, plus the falling of the water table, and lots and lots of other elements, so on, are certainly important socially for the stability which the Communist Party always prizes so much. But what you get, and you got in the Xinhua official statement on Sunday night that I just mentioned, is that China is going to decide how important pollution is compared with economic growth, compared with pushing up consumption, compared with dealing with property crisis and other elements there. And it's not going to be led by others. At the same time, China will push ahead with renewables. It's already well down that path. And indeed, you know, a push towards greater use of renewables around the world will probably actually be yet another fillip for Chinese exports.
Mary, is there a danger, though, possibly heightened by China and Russia not coming, that with climate change we will see the equivalent of the nonsensical culture wars which have developed around COVID-19, i.e. people trying to strike political positions over a fact of nature that really couldn't care less one way or the other?
I mean, I think that's possibly a danger, but I think the bigger danger is a sort of north-south rift, if you like, between rich countries and poor countries. Because, so far as I understand, nothing like the compensation promises for less developed countries to change their policy and to develop in a climate-friendly way, nothing like that has been would be realistic, has been either pledged or paid. So I think that's likely to be the bigger rift. The other question, which is sort of in play, but I think is in some ways a false question, is whether Russia and China might actually join forces and develop their own policies and present some sort of semi-united front at Glasgow. I mean, I think that's probably not going to happen, because I don't think that Russia and China they've not really developed anything like a joint policy on this. They're pursuing their own paths. So I don't think that can happen, but I can see that from a European perspective, that could be seen as potentially a threat.
Well, let's stick with China, because roughly 100,000 people have left Hong Kong in the last year, the city's biggest annual population decrease in more than six decades. It seems safe to assume that this is not coincidental with the new national security law imposed on Hong Kong by China in 2020, a law which dramatically reduced such autonomy as the city still had and threatened draconian punishment upon any citizen who was in any respect unhappy about this. That exodus has now been joined by Amnesty International, which will close its Hong Kong office this year. Amnesty says that the national security law makes its operations impossible. Jonathan, will the news that Amnesty International, of all organisations, is leaving Hong Kong be causing anguished rethinking of this policy among the Chinese Communist Party?
No, absolutely not.
Funny, I thought you might say something like
probably
that.
Probably on the contrary. It will be seen as proof that these NGOs are all in league with foreign intriguers who are trying to undermine the Communist Party and use Hong Kong as a battering ram to do that, I think.
Mary, not dissimilar things have occurred in Russia, where it is quite common, again, for NGOs to be depicted by the Russian government as meddling agents of various nefarious Western interests, etc. We all know how it goes. But for any NGO attempting to operate, and let's assume operating in good faith, what is the argument for staying versus going?
Well, the argument for staying versus going is that you are a sort of, even if you can't do very much, you're sort of a symbolic presence there. And you provide a base and a frame of reference for people who, at very least, question the regime and a sense of solidarity. But of course, that at the same time renders both the people who may approach them, maybe under their wing, vulnerable, and the organisation itself. And I think there's another problem, which is less in the countries where they might hesitate about staying or going. But I think, you know, if you look at somewhere like Ukraine, or you look at the relatively recent countries that have joined the European Union and NATO. If you look at Burma, for instance, and you look at NGOs there, and Afghanistan would be another absolute prime example, that what you've got are NGOs who are staffed partly by and are training people in their own and in a sort of Western image. And the extent to which they're looking outside their country rather than helping people in their country, I think there's a real issue there. And I think you could see it so clearly with Afghanistan that we, or the Western NGOs, educated and trained a whole cadre of people. And then what happened when the regime fell? We evacuated them all. So we created a class and then we removed them. So I think there are real arguments for actually looking again at the role of NGOs. I'm not talking about charities, not talking about aid workers, I'm talking specifically about NGOs of the type of Amnesty International.
There's a related question there, I think, Jonathan, which we are also seeing where Hong Kong is concerned, that the United Kingdom, of course, made this extraordinary offer of residency to perhaps as many as 5 million people who might be qualified as BNO, or, you know, holders of the national overseas, British overseas passport, or their dependents. The UK government says that up to 150,000 Hong Kongers are expected this year. Is there some sort of way forward there for countries where there is a human rights issue to basically say, within reason, all right, we'll take them?
Yes, if they really are willing to take them, that's the question. And if people want to come, I mean, that's the other question. Mm. Because, for instance, before the handover of Hong Kong from Britain to China in 1997, a lot of people, I was in Hong Kong at the time, and a lot of people in Hong Kong got foreign passports, particularly Australian, New Zealand, Canadian. They didn't actually want to leave Hong Kong at that point, but they wanted somewhere to go if they had to.
It's the
insurance policy there. Yeah, exactly there. I mean, the other thing, just to come back to the amnesty case in Hong Kong, is that the national security law makes a big thing, and the prosecutions under it have made a big thing, of links with foreigners. And, of course, if you're an international NGO like Amnesty, it's rather difficult not to have links with foreigners.
Jonathan Fenby and Mary Dajewski, thank you both for the moment. You are listening to The Daily. We will have more from our panel right after this.
Allianz is proud to partner The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
Since 1890, Allianz has stood side by side with people as they overcame the impossible. Allianz has always been an innovator. Allianz secures people's future, giving them confidence in tomorrow. Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side, to provide solid and sustainable solutions. Allianz strives to do it right, with passion, every day. Allianz. Confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Now, for most of us, the opaque world of global shipping isn't really something we have to think much about. That is, until our daily supply of Amazon packages and exotic supermarket fruits comes grinding to a sudden halt. With global supply chains currently in crisis and many ports around the world facing significant labour shortages and backlogs, we asked Elizabeth Brough, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, to unpack the world of shipping and explain why all of this matters.
Soon may the wellerman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum, sailors used to sing in the famous sea shanty wellerman. But this year, sailors are struggling to deliver the massive amounts of goods global consumers expect. That's not just the result of one mishap, but of vast and complex global supply chains. Instead of getting annoyed about delayed goods, we should shorten supply chains. Ships now carry some 11 billion tons of goods per year, 1.5 tons for every person on the planet. Indeed, the shipping industry is growing so quickly that shipping companies are buying ever larger vessels. The 50,000 cargo vessels currently traversing the world's oceans include several members of the new ultra-large container vessel ULCV class, which can carry up to 24,000 containers each. Port workers will swiftly unload some of the ship's massive cargo, load them with new containers, and get the newly arrived containers onto trucks and rail cars. Any mishap can cause knock-on delays. That's precisely what's happening at the Port of Los Angeles, where dozens of vessels are waiting to dock and some 500,000 containers are waiting to begin their land journey. Chinese ports, where COVID-19 outbreaks have prevented vessels from docking, have recently been causing similar disruption to global shipping. The global shipping industry has turned the extremely complex business of delivering goods around the world into such a phenomenally efficient operation that global consumers have forgotten how easily something can go wrong. Indeed, because most of us suffer from sea blindness, we don't give any thought to container supply or ships being unable to dock. We forget, too, that every ship needs crews, and very few Westerners go to sea anymore. Today, China, the Philippines, Russia, and Indonesia supply the largest numbers of seafarers. I think we have made some inroads in offering mental and physical health support to our seafarers, because ultimately, if we don't put that in place, it will be bad for business because nobody will want to go away to sea. And Guy Platten, the Secretary General of the International Chamber of Shipping, recently told a conference. Like all companies, businesses in the shipping sector want to grow. But the future supply of seafarers is not the only risk to the business. The fewest ports can accommodate those large ULCVs. And China's increasing hold on the sector poses an even bigger challenge. The fast-growing Chinese company COSCO is an all-round giant that owns and operates 410 container vessels and ports as well. Greece's port of Piraeus are among the Western ports majority owned by COSCO, which also recently bought a large stake in the port of Hamburg in Germany and operates 357 terminals in 36 ports around the world, in addition to the ones it owns. Its Chinese sibling Shanghai International Port Group recently acquired the rights to the port of Haifa in Israel. Chinese firms now have a stake in more than 100 ports in 63 countries around the world. While European container shipping companies still dominate the market and also own ports, Chinese firms' superior access to financing means their share will keep growing. What's more, extreme weather events are increasing. Last month, two of China's largest ports had to close as hurricanes approached. We may, in fact, have reached peak shipping. To be sure, lots of goods and components can only be shipped from other countries. But many other goods are available closer to home, albeit sometimes at higher prices. Shorter supply chains bring fewer risks of mishaps, piracy, and state-sponsored sabotage. Buying more locally would support domestic manufacturing and help us steer clear of disappointments such as this year's predicted shortage of Christmas products. And it would make us less dependent on China, too.
That was Elizabeth Brough, Resident Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Still with me on The Daily are our guests Mary Dajewski and Jonathan Fenby. Jonathan, following up on what Elizabeth was talking about there, do we or should we get used to a world in which exotic fruits are not at our neighbourhood corner shop all year round?
I don't know that we should, but it may well be the case that we have to there. I mean, I still would hanker after my oranges freshly pressed each morning, my Chinese tea, which goes after it and with it, and all the other things which one's got used to. But this is a convenience economy that we've got used to for as consumers.
This is true, Mary. It does occasionally occur to me that grateful though I am for this, or certainly more grateful though I was pre-Brexit for it, there does seem something slightly ludicrous about the fact that I can walk up to a corner shop in a not terrifically glamorous suburb of East London and buy a nice package of, you know, fresh asparagus from Peru. I mean, on the one hand, sort of miraculous, even vaguely romantic, but on the other, are we taking a bit of a liberty?
Well, I think both Jonathan and I have lived in France, and there's a huge difference between France and Britain insofar as seasonal fresh goods. In France, I remember that you would get the first strawberries from Morocco, then they'd come from Spain, then they'd come from the southwest of France, then they'd come from the south of France, and gradually you'd watch as the seasons change and the produce changed, which is much more difficult to do in Britain because we import stuff all year round. I'm not sure whether that's going to continue, because one of the interesting things after Brexit that you notice in supermarkets is that a lot more goods, a lot more food is branded with a Union Jack as made in Britain, which is sort of like it used to be 30, 40 years ago. And it's almost as though that's become a sort of point of pride. So it may be that the supply chains are shortening for different reasons, or not just for the reasons that there are problems with shipping.
Jonathan, I will rise above an Australian's joke about British food just for the moment.
But I
do wonder if perhaps the British might have a bit of a head start in acclimatizing to a world such as the one that we have been describing, because it is my contention that a big part of the thing that underpinned the vote for Brexit was that at some subliminal, nostalgic level, you people want shortages, you want rationing, and you want hardship.
We want to go back to the 1940s.
Indeed.
Yes, yes, yes. I am longing to have Spam. Except I think that was imported from America. So you can get some pretty horrible stuff imported too. It's not just the homegrown stuff. But of course, the supply chain issue is probably more important when it comes to industry and to the worldwide circulation of components there, which is why, you know, China is particularly important, not just as a shipper, but as a producer. And companies, we saw this with motor cars, for instance, the motor car industry, grinding to a halt, basically, because the right electronic components weren't arriving.
This is their just-in-time supply chain.
Just-in-time supplier, which is, again, part of the convenience that we've got used to.
OK, well, there is, I'm sure, something about... There's a link somewhere in supply chain expertise teeing up our final item, because it does refer to the Colombian drug baron, Pablo Escobar. He died a largely unlamented death in a shootout with police back in 1993. His legacy endures, however, possibly most inconveniently in the form of a herd of hippopotamuses. Escobar spent some of his vast ill-gotten fortune importing a few of the hefty pachyderms to his Colombian Colombian ranch, where they prospered to the extent that there are now roughly 80 of the things. Local authorities seeking to cull or sterilise them are bemused, as of now, I should think, by a US court judgment which has decided that the hippos are interested persons under American law. Now, Mary, obviously this has been abbreviated into lots of chortling headlines along the lines of US court declares hippopotamus as people, which isn't quite what has happened. But basically, this is nonsense, isn't it? This is the Animal Legal Defence Fund who have brought this suit trying to prove some ludicrous, sentimental, anthropomorphic point.
Well, it is. I mean, it is absolutely ludicrous. But of course, we're not really talking about people. We're talking about things being given the status of a legal entity, which gives them certain rights under certain legal systems. I still think that's taking it way too far. But there is quite, a strong movement, and it includes in the UK, because I think there's a law going through Parliament at the moment, which is to recognise animals as sentient beings that you can only treat in certain ways. I'm not quite sure what stage this is at. But I think that there is an evolution of views about animals, which says that they should maybe have more rights and should be treated with rather more compassion than maybe in the past.
See, I have nothing against hippopotamuses. I would not wish any listener to take away from this broadcast any sense that I am anti-hippopotamus. But Jonathan, I do come from a country, i.e. Australia, which has had a habit since the invasion by the British in the late 18th century of importing animals from elsewhere. In not one instance that I can think of has it gone terrifically well for the local habitat and the inhabitants thereof. And most of those animals were of the size of, you know, rabbits or cane toads, not hippopotamuses. Which are a considerable nuisance. So is the question not that the habitat and biodiversity of the native country should take priority, should it not? Because
yes.
there will be things dwelling in Colombia which are very much not evolved to have to deal with a hippopotamus.
Yeah, and you don't want them to get into the supply chain, certainly. No, we don't care about that. But, I mean, on the question of treatment
or
of animals...
Or indeed your swimming pool.
Indeed, yes. Well, I don't have a swimming pool. But I remember when I was in Germany as a correspondent at the end of the last century, there was a celebrated case in the state capital of Hanover, Lower Saxony, where the Lower Saxon Greens lighted on a pig called Louisa, who'd been used to sniff for drugs. And Louisa, the police had decided to replace Louisa with dogs. And Louisa was going to be basically cut up and made into bacon or ham hocks or whatever. And the Greens raised a great furore in the state parliament, and Louisa was officially classed as a civil servant and was given a pension and was put in a state-run pigsty for the rest of her life.
It's a shocking example of pork barrel politics, you might say.
Indeed, you could. Oh, you got there before me. Yes. Now, whether this would happen to the hippos is an open question.
Well, I mean, but finally on this, Mary, what I do end up wondering in cases like this is how much they are governed by, you know, basic human sentimentality, in that we get much soppier about some animals than we do about others. There is, in this country, for example, a persistent tradition of sentimentalization of the fox. Again, I like foxes. I have many resident...
You have many friends who are foxes.
I do. They are semi-resident in my garden. I'm always happy to see them. I'm not against them. But you don't ever see people in Britain getting terribly sentimental about, for example, the pursuit and extermination of, you know, mice, rats, various other nuisances.
No, and I think that, I mean, I was slightly surprised that there was such sentimental sympathy for hippopotamuses in this respect, because to my mind, they're not particularly one of the most sympathetic creatures.
I think they're very sympathetic from a very safe distance.
A very safe distance, but I can imagine many more, starting with koalas and zebras, things like that, that I would immediately slap the equivalent of sort of lifelong conservation orders on.
Jonathan, is there anything you'd like to slap a lifelong conservation order? We've given Mary koalas and zebras. You can have two.
Oh, I have to say the human race.
Oh,
really? Okay, well,
is that enough?
Yeah, somebody is still holding out hope for the bipedal species there, Mary. On that upbeat thought, that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Jonathan Fenby and Mary Dijewski. Also to Thomas Lewis and Elizabeth Brough. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.